Welcome everyone. Welcome to home once again for another Kabbalah series. This time we're talking about the Kabbalah of personal growth. So what I want to do just as an introduction, before we get into some deeper mystical concepts, just want to give you a bit of context and sort of an introduction. Hi, how can I just grab some chairs from here? Take some handouts, just to. Let me just grab some chairs, bring them around from the back over there. Sort of also why I chose this topic specifically now. So we know that in the Jewish calendar, we're actually in a period of the year which is designed for personal growth and spiritual growth. It's called the period of the Omer. We count the Omer. Now, often people, when we say the Omer, people think of it as a period we're not supposed to make weddings or listen to music and things like that, which is also partially true because it happens to be in the same time of the year, but that's not the reason it's called the Omer. The reason it's called the Omer is because it's a period where we are commanded in the Torah to count 7 weeks, to count 49 days from the second day of Pesach, commemorating when the Jews left Egypt. They counted towards Shavuot, which is the festival in a few weeks. The day that we received the Torah at Mount Sinai. And the way it worked was that they left Egypt on the 15th of Nisan, and then the next day they began to count. But subsequently God commanded it on the second day of Pesach, and we'll come to the significance of this towards the end hopefully. They were told to bring a special flower offering in the tabernacle, in the Mishkan, in the Beit HaMikdash, in the temple. And the flower offering, whenever there was a flower offering in the temple, it was always made out of wheat. And this particular one was made out of barley, which hopefully at the end we'll have time to explain what it's got to do with the topic. But it was actually very specifically. But the idea was that God gave us 7 weeks, that's okay, as a period of self-development and spiritual growth and personal refinement and working on our personality. And we'll see why 7 weeks in a moment. And the idea is that it's supposed to be a time where we grow, where we change, and we work on our own, nurture our strengths, take responsibility for our weaknesses, and so on and so forth. Now, we know that growth, the concept of growth, the concept of going beyond our comfort zone, the concept of going beyond ourselves for that matter, right, is really the essence of being human. Particularly from a Jewish concept, particularly as a Jew, being growing, going beyond ourselves, taking the next step, constantly growing, is really essential. It's critical to who we are, critical to the human experience, and that's why this time of year is designated to that personal growth concept. Because when we have the festival of Pesach, of Passover, it's the commemoration of us going out of Egypt, and I think we've spoken about it before that the going out of Egypt wasn't just a geographical redemption or historic redemption for people who were enslaved physically from an oppressive nation, but it was actually much more of a spiritual experience. Where when the Jews left Egypt, they were given this gift of freedom. They were given the gift of being able to grow, being able to make choices, to go contrary to our normal natural disposition, to work on our personality, to unlock ourselves and untrap ourselves from who we are. And we are taught that the process of going out of Egypt was not a one-time event, nor is it a one-time event once a year when we commemorate it on Pesach, but it's something we're supposed to commemorate every day. In fact, in our prayers, we often, very often, if daily, in fact, twice daily, particularly, but more than twice daily sometimes, we talk about commemorating the going out of Egypt because it's part of our journey, it's part of who we are. We're always going out of our own Egypt. The word Egypt, I think we mentioned this last time, the word Egypt in Hebrew is Mitzrayim, which means Egypt in Hebrew, but it also means the word Meitzar, to be constricted, to be imprisoned, incarcerated, trapped within ourselves. And the idea of going out of Mitzrayim is going beyond our own prison walls, our symbolic prison walls, right? And that's a lifelong journey. It's not that we grow one time and we improve and then we get comfortable and we live our rest of our life. It's not that way at all. Growth is something which is supposed to be continuous. It's supposed to be something which is a constant journey. In fact, that's the purpose of our existence, to constantly strive to be higher. I tell a story of, I'll tell you two little stories just again by way of introduction. there was a great master of ethics. He was the founder of the Musar movement, the movement that learns a lot of material literature on self-development and so on. His name was Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, and they tell a story that he was once going home at night, very late. It was dark in a shtetl, and he passed by the tailor's home, and he saw in the window that the candle was burning, it was still light, and the tailor was still working. So he knocked on the door, and he knew the tailor, and the tailor knew him. And he says to him, "Why are you still working? It's late at night." So he told him in Yiddish, he says, "Rebbe," I'll say it in Yiddish and I'll translate it, he said, "Kol zman de lichte le brent, darf man arbeiten, kann man noch verrichten." He said, "As long as the candle is burning, we can still fix." So Rousseau Solante said, "Wow, what a lesson." He said that was the greatest lesson, the moral lesson he had for the day, that as long as the candle meaning the soul, is burning, as long as we're alive, there's always things to improve on. There's always, it's an infinite process. Always things we can do better. Always things we can improve. And always grow higher and strive higher and so on. They tell a story of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who was always about pushing boundaries, always encouraged people to do more and to go out of what they're comfortable with. And once they get comfortable with it, to do that again and so on. So there was a person who came to visit him. A well-known person, I don't know, a philanthropist, someone, some big machas, they say in the Jewish world, right? And this guy wasn't particularly observant, he wasn't a chassid, he wasn't a follower of the rabbi, he just came to visit him and he had a private audience with him. And they discussed whatever they discussed, and this person was quite impressed and so on. And towards the end of the audience, he turned to the rabbi and he said, "Rebbe, I want to ask you a question, but you need to understand who I am. My background, I'm not particularly religious, I'm not particularly spiritual, I'm not, et cetera, et cetera." He says, "But I would like to be counted as one of your followers, one of your chassidim. Is that like a very arrogant question to ask? And if yes, how do I do that?" And so on. So Rebbe smiled at him and he said, "I want to tell you something." He says, "Any person," he says, "who goes to sleep at night and makes a commitment that tomorrow is going to be better than today, I'm proud to call him my chassid." That was his thing. So it doesn't matter where you are. It's not a matter where you are on the journey. It's about your aspiration to grow. That was the concept. And in fact, the Talmud tells us an interesting thing. The Talmud tells us, and I'll just finish the introduction with this. The Talmud tells us that the Talmud quotes a particular verse and says a really strange thing, a cryptic thing if we don't understand the context. But it says the following. It says that if a person studies, reviews their learning. The Talmud is discussing the concept of Jewish learning and learning new concepts in Torah and so on. And the Talmud says that whoever reviews their learning 100 times is not considered a servant of God. But whoever reviews their learning 101 times is. He's a servant of God. Which obviously is a cryptic statement. What do they mean by that? So the explanation of it is because in ancient times where the oral law, the Talmud, was all studied by heart, it was only later that it was written down, it was common practice to review anything you learned a lot of times. Right? And in fact, the common practice was to review something you learned 100 times. Right? That was the standard mainstream academic practice, so to speak, in the yeshivot, in the houses of learning. And I mean, that's an interesting thing because nowadays we find it difficult to review something 3 times, but right, our attention span is not that great these days. But they had determination those days. They used to review the learning 100 times. So the Talmud says that if someone who just keeps doing that and never does it more than 100 times, that's not a servant of God because they're just doing what they used to. It's a good thing, they're doing a good thing, but they're not pushing themselves, right? But someone who does it 101 times, that one time extra, that one push, that's considered a servant of God, right? So that's the just a little introduction about the concept of growth. But we need to understand what it all means. What does personal growth really mean? In other words, we need to understand the greatness. Like, why is it such a great thing to push our comfort zone? Why is it such a great thing to grow? And what gives us the ability to grow? What gives us humans that ability to change or improve or to become untrapped and so on, right? Which is the key to success, by the way. In more modern literature, in psychological literature, there's some great literature by great writings by a woman called Carol Dweck. I don't know if anyone's heard of her, but she developed this whole theory in modern psychology called the growth mindset, where she did amazing research with kids, actually, particularly kids. and measured the success, which kids were successful and which weren't, and it came out that it had very little to do with natural talent. I mean, it does sometimes, but it had very little to do with natural skill or natural academic talent. It had all to do with the determination to grow. Now, what she was studying was natural tendencies, so of course some kids naturally push themselves more than others, but her thesis, her whole teachings was the difference between a fixed mindset and a growth mindset. And essentially the concept was that a fixed mindset is someone who defines themselves by what they think their skills and talents are.
Excuse me, Rabbi, I've talked pretty badly. Your neighbor can get out.
But okay, that's good.
Is that okay?
He doesn't go anywhere this time of the night, though. Okay. And if he does, he knows where I am. That's okay. So she talks about the fixed mindset. Fixed mindset is a person that defines themselves. I think this is really the essence of what we're talking about. Defines themselves by who they are, naturally. In other words, they have talents, they're good at maths, they're good at this, they're good at that. That's the way they define themselves, which is a very bad way to define yourself, because we're actually not defined by the dispositions that we have, not intellectually and not emotionally. What we'll see is that we're actually defined by a much deeper thing. We're defined by the ability to go beyond who we are. It takes work, it takes determination, and that was the whole thing that she, you know, encouraged teachers and educationalists to create kids and students with the growth mindset rather than with a fixed mindset. And I'm just summarizing one second. It's a big body of work, but you can Google it. It's very fascinating stuff. But what I want to really do tonight is understand it from a Jewish perspective, understand it from a Kabbalistic perspective, and what does it all mean? So let me go through a couple of things. First of all, when we talk about what personal growth is, it's not about reaching a state of perfection. In fact, it's very not about perfection, right? And it's not a means to an end either. In other words, growth is not about I need to reach a certain goal and therefore I'm going to try and grow and reach it, right? Because then it finishes and then the goal is not the growth. What we need to understand is that as a human being, growth is actually, in other words, the journey of growth is the goal itself. And in fact, as human beings, we may never reach perfection because human beings are imperfect, right? And that's our greatness. Our greatness is that we're imperfect and we're able to grow as long as we keep growing, right? Growing just means that we grow beyond who we are now until we get comfortable with that, and then we take the next step of who we are then. But we keep doing that, right? Now, we know that it's a lifelong mission, and in fact, we learn in Tanakh, in the Torah, the difference between the human being and the angel. Judaism believes in angels. And angels are very lofty, spiritual, pure, pristine beings. And yet in Tanakh, when it makes references to angels versus human beings, it calls the angels omdim. Omdim means stationary beings. Okay. As opposed to the human, who's called omdim. Mahalchim, sorry. Those who walk, those who grow. In other words, interestingly enough, although we are far from perfect, and we are certainly much less holy than angels are spiritual, godly beings. We are mortals, we are mundane, we have our rough side to us, we have our mundane tendencies, we have our materialistic part of who we are, and so on and so forth. And yet infinity, as we'll see later, infinity, the ability to be infinite, rests within the human being, not within the angel. The angel is perfect as the angel is a finite being. And the way the angel is created, and angels have a personality, a spiritual personality, an emotional personality, as we know, Kabbalah teaches us that there's what we call angels of love and angels of fear and so on. The personality with which an angel is created becomes its personality and becomes its definition. So angels, like the rest of creation, are defined by who they are, by their personality, by their parameters, by their properties. The only exception, in fact, is the human being, the imperfect human being. Our perfection is our greatness. Our perfection gives us the ability, notwithstanding our imperfections, we have the ability to be infinite, which means to go beyond who we are. That's, by the way, unique to the human being. Only the human being can do that. No animals, no angels, no other creation. The definition of a creation is that it's got a definition. only being that's similar to God in a way. We're not God, obviously, but the only human being, the only being that has a godly trait to it in terms of its infinity is the human being. And although we are imperfect, but nevertheless, that's our greatness. Our greatness is that we remain with our imperfections, but yet we can go beyond who we are, we can grow. And that's the greatness of the human being. So that's the first thing to understand. And that's the, therefore the mission of being human. The mission of being human our entire life. Always to grow. Like the story of Bissau Salanta. As long as this candle is burning, we can always improve. We can always become greater. And there's no end to it because it's an infinite journey. Because it comes from a place of infinity from within ourselves, as we'll soon see. So that's one thing to understand about growth. The second is just to understand, we talk about growth, especially personality growth and self-development and so forth. The imagery that we think of is fixing a part of our personality. So for example, everyone has their own weaknesses, someone might get angry a lot, someone might be jealous, someone might have resentment, someone might be overindulgent. It might be a spiritual flaw, whatever the case is, right? It might be lack of self-control, lack of self-discipline. So we always think of removing a bad trait, removing a weakness in our personality, removing resentment, letting go of resentment, removing jealousy, removing the desire to do revenge, removing the trait of being weak in self-control, right? But actually, Kabbalistically, we are taught that it's very much not that at all. It is like that temporarily, but actually it's not about that. It's much more about channeling. It's about understanding that, for the most part, every trait that we have, and this is a very important part of growth, every trait that we have, every part of us really, every part of our personality, is a godly created trait. Right? Which means, therefore, that all the personality traits that we do have, and those that we don't have and would like to embrace, as we'll talk about, is godly. And if it's godly, it's intrinsically not negative. Anything negative about us, right? Any trait that we have that we think upon reflection, when we do an inventory and we honest with ourselves, and we all have flaws and we all have weaknesses, we all have strengths and weaknesses. And part of being human and part of growing is to understand that we're not defined by our weaknesses, and therefore we should feel secure enough to take responsibility for them, right? But part of taking responsibility for them is to understand that they can be channeled, they can be led, they can be guided into something positive because they're intrinsically good. This is a tremendous concept in educationists as well. We see kids with weaknesses. Obviously, often we try to suppress the things which we don't like. Now, temporarily, you do need to suppress. I mean, if someone is aggressive, you've got to stop that aggression. But it's the manifestation of the trait that is negative. It's not the trait itself. That's an important thing to bear in mind. We'll see why that is in a few moments. So let's jump in here. There's something more, something deep and something Kabbalistic. So to understand this, we need to understand how the makeup of the human being. Now, we know that one of the things people always talk about, right, is that human beings are created, what we call in Hebrew, B'Tselem Elohim, in God's image, right? So we talk about human being having a godly imprint, right? We often apply that principle in terms of how we need to respect every human being, we need to have a concept of human dignity, all that kind of stuff, because we look at another human being, like them or don't like them, but they're created B'Tselem Elohim in the image of God, right? What does that mean? I'm sure you've all heard that expression, right? The person is created B'Tselem Elohim. But what does that mean? What does it mean to be created in the image of God? First of all, God has no physical image, right? It's one of the fundamentals of Jewish belief, right? It's in the Yigdal song that we sing on Friday night, right? One of the paragraphs says, "In no guf, he's not a body," right? Because that's one of the fundamental beliefs of Jewish principles. So what does it mean that a person, a human being, is created in the image of God? What does that mean? Sorry?
The traits
that we have. Okay, what is it? Yeah, so we need to develop that. That's correct.
It's not the physical, the way when you're young, you're told, you know, the image of God you created. It's not the physical. So it must be something spiritual.
Right. So you need to understand what that is and why it's called the image of God. Okay?
Because God's
Well, we're not perfect, so yeah by any stretch of imagination. Yeah, that's true, of course, it comes to this part, but let's sort of develop what that actually means in terms of the traits that you're talking about, right? So first of all, we say that the human being is created in the image of God. Before we talk about what that means, we should ask a question: what's the human being? Who are we? Because we're actually quite a complex machine, really, if you think about it, right? So let's talk about it in the context spoken about in the famous book of Tanya, which is the sort of the foundation of the Hasidic philosophy in Chabad, written by the first Chabad Rebbe, Rav Shnei Zalman of Lavitz. It's like magnum opus, so to speak, right? And the Tanya is based on one concept. And it goes to the heart of what growth is, really. The Tanya talks about the struggle that exists within the human being, the constant struggle that exists within almost all human beings. We are told that every generation God plants a couple of perfect people. If you're one of those, then you're probably at the wrong address, but God plants a couple of perfect individuals just to be sort of, you know, the role model of what perfection looks like. But otherwise, most of us are not perfect, and most of us have inner struggles. So I'm not talking about outer struggles, I'm talking inner struggles, right? Struggles, personality struggles, turmoils, inner conflict, and so on and so forth. Where does it come from? It comes from the fact that he says we have two souls. We have what's called the Nefesh Elokit, the godly soul, and the Nefesh Habamit, the animal soul. Right? I don't want anyone going away from here tonight, like not sure who they are anymore, right? But it is that way. We have the inner war, the inner constant struggle between the godly soul and the animal soul. So in summary, this is a large topic, but the godly soul, of course, is that soul within us, which is godly, meaning it's a soul that drives and motivates and inspires us to seek higher meaning and purpose, to seek godliness, to seek spirituality, to be selfless, to be connected to God, to understand God. And it's all about being focused on higher being, focused on godliness, right? The animal soul is that like an animal. It's an animal soul which is much more impulsive. It's the soul which drives us for and is behind the will, the desire to have physical survival, but not only physical survival, it is the source of some of our weaknesses. It's ego-driven, it's about self-preservation, self-interest, self-pleasure, animalistic. It's not as mature, it's like an animal, just like an animal is instinctive and impulsive, acts on emotion. This soul also primarily is driven by sort of emotional impulsive responses, and so on and so forth, right? So we've got two souls, and they struggle with each other for mastery. Who's going to be in charge, kind of thing, right? Now, the thing to understand is we call them both souls, right? Because when we talk about the human being being created in the image of God, we don't only mean the godly soul. It's not only about the godly spark that's in us. Every part of us is created by God, and every part of us is created in the image of God. Both the godly soul and the animal soul. The animal soul just needs a bit of work to reveal it. It needs guidance from the godly soul. But ultimately, intrinsically, the animal soul is a godly created being. It's not intrinsically bad. The other day I was talking to someone about the godly soul, so they asked me, is this the same thing as what we call in the classic Jewish literature, the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, right? I'm sure you've heard this concept. We have what's called the Yetzer Tov and the Yetzer Hara, the inclination to do good, the inclination to do bad. So am I confusing it? Is this two names for one thing? And the answer is it's not. The Yetzer Hara is a derivative of the animal soul, meaning the animal soul left untamed, left untrained, left unguided, will result in the willingness to do bad. But the animal soul is animalistic, but animalistic doesn't necessarily mean it's intrinsically bad. It can be channeled, like we said before, in something really good. So my point is we have both the animal soul and the godly soul, and both are created in the image of God. Now, what does it mean to be created in the image of God? So let's understand. So here, I need to take you through a little bit of a Kabbalistic journey. I know it's a bit late at night, and I hope this is going to work, but let's try. So Kabbalah teaches us, you need to look at your handout for this. Have a look at number 5. Okay. Kabbalah, particularly in the works of the Arizal, is very much based on a system of 10 powers, which we call 10 Sfirot. Now, these also happen to be what we call the 10 powers of the soul, but I'm not talking about that for a moment. Right? The 10 Sfirot are 10 godly powers with which God, 10 godly tools with which God used to sort of create the world, create the universe. Now, let's understand the origin of these 10 Sfirot. So Kabbalah teaches us that, and Arizal talks about this, the great Kabbalist, the Arizal talks about this concept, and he says the following. First of all, our world is not the only world. We know that our world is the last of the chain of worlds, right? If you lose me in the middle, please tell me, okay? I'll try and make it as clear as I can, because it's a big topic, but I want to just sort of try and make it as clear as possible. So we have in Kabbalah something called Seder Hishtalshelut, which means the evolution of worlds. Not to be confused with Darwinism, right? There's this, the mystical evolution of worlds, meaning that we have a chain of worlds, one higher than the other, one more godly than the other, one evolving from the other until the chain comes all the way down. And Kabbalah talks about four worlds, and we are the product, us physical. The physical universe is the product of the fourth world. Those four worlds are called Atzilut, Bri'ah, Yetzirah, and Asiyah. The names aren't important for tonight. And each world is governed by these 10 Sfirot, right? These 10 powers of creation, originating from the first world. The first world is Atzilut. Now, the first world is called the world of Atzilut. It's different to all the others. The world of Atzilut is known as God's world. That's God's world. What does it mean, God's world? So the concept is like this. God in his essence transcends any form of finiteness, right? God in his essence transcends any form of definition. There was a great debate between one of the great philosophers called the Maharal of Prague, who argued with Maimonides, the Rambam, where Maimonides talks about the greatness of God's intellect. The very beginning of Maimonides, he talks about the greatness of God's intellect. He says, you mustn't think that God's intellect is similar to the human intellect. It's completely different. It's infinite. And he says a whole bunch of things about God's intellect. So the Maharal of Prague came along and says, I know that you're trying to understand the greatness of God, but why are you talking about God in the context of intellect altogether? Intellect is a definition, even if it's infinite intellect. Right? We talk about God being kind. Kind is a human definition. How can you talk about God in these terms altogether? Right? So that's how the debate began. Came along the Arizal and explained like this. He said like this, God is truly infinite, meaning infinite, not that he can do a lot of something, but infinite means he has no definition. In fact, this is alluded to in the famous Midrash, where Moses lands up at the burning bush, and God tells him to go down to Egypt and redeem the Jewish people. And he says, when I come down to Egypt and I tell the Jewish people that I was sent and I'm going to redeem you, they're going to ask me, what's his name? Like, this boss that you're representing, what is he? And God said, I have no name. Depends what I'm doing. What does it mean, I have no name? Meaning, because a name is a descriptive thing. A name describes. And God says, I have no name because God in his essence is transcendent. Transcendent means purely transcendent means he has no definition whatsoever. Right? He's above any definition. You cannot ascribe a description to him, even if that description is very lofty. This is what the Maharal was trying to say. Even the description which is infinite, but it's still a description. A description means it's defined, it's something and not something else. Right? However, said the Arizal, and this is spoken about by one of the other great Kabbalists, he says the following. If God is truly infinite, he must also possess the power to be finite if he wants to, if he so desires. Why? Because if you say that God is only infinite and cannot be finite, you've just made him finite. You get that?
Can you say that again?
If you say that God can only be infinite, right, and he cannot be finite, then you've made him finite. Finite means it stops at a certain point and it cannot go somewhere else. If God can only be infinite and he cannot be finite if he chooses to, then you've made him finite. It means he's limited to being infinite. Okay, am I making sense? So therefore, God, if he so chooses, could manifest himself in a way that is finite too. So says the Arizal, that God desired, for whatever reason, that's not relevant right now, but God desired, and we might not know the true reason anyway, but we know what he wanted, but we don't know why he wanted it necessarily, right? But God desired a finite existence, he desired this world, and he desired to have a relationship with this world, okay? So in order for him to have a relationship with this world, he chose to reveal within himself 10 finite descriptions, which we now know as the 10 Sefirot. In other words, God chose to manifest himself, to express himself in 10 defined ways. And that's what we know in Kabbalah as the world of Atzilut. It's God still, but it's not God in his undefined essence. It's God how he chooses himself, how he chooses to manifest himself through a process which Kabbalah calls Tzimtzum. In other words, he chooses to limit himself, which he can do. Not because he's intrinsically finite, but because he chooses to manifest himself in 10 defined descriptions, known as the 10 Sefirot. And that's his world of definition, the world of Atzilut. So if you look, yeah, are we okay so far? Yeah.
Is
Tzimtzum
also, does it mean like concealment, to be concealed?
Yes. Okay. So he conceals his infinity, so to speak, his undefinedness.
Right. And what does Atzilut mean?
So Atzilut comes from the word Eitzel, to be close to. Meaning it's, because the next world after Atzilut is called Briah. Briah means, it's the first created world. It means it's really a creation, it's outside of, so to speak, outside of God's essence. Mm-hmm. But Atzilut is a world, it's a defined world, but it's still Eitzel, it's close to him, it's still within him. It's his world. Another translation of Atzilut means emanation, meaning it's his emanations, it's his expressions, his manifestations. Right? Yeah, we're all good so far? Yeah? Okay. So if you have a look at the chart there where it says the 10 Sefirot, I put first of all the idea of Keter. Keter means crown. So in Kabbalah, we have this concept that before the evolution of worlds begin, we've got what we call Ein Sof, the infinite light of God, right? God in his pure infinity, known as Keter. And that's where his ratzon, his desire, lives, so to speak, right? I'll give you an example. Even within ourselves, what's the part of us which is most us, so to speak, right? It's in Kabbalah, it says it's our will, it's our desire, right? If you want something, it's because you want it, right? Now, you might want to be kind. So kindness is a particular personality. You might want to, I don't know, run, or you might want to be happy, or want to be kind, or want to be harsh, or whatever the case is, right? So harshness, kindness, that's all descriptive, that's all things we do. But why do we do them? Because we have a ratzon, we have a will. That's us. I want to, right? So the ratzon of God, that's known as Keter. That's the crown above the world of Atzilut. That's the world of infinity, the world of transcendence, the world that's not defined. And then God decides, he chooses part of his will to express himself in 10 definitions, which are known as the 10 Sefirot, right? So let's just run through them quickly. And tonight's purpose was not to understand each of the 10 Sefirot, because that's beyond the scope of this hour. But essentially, the world, the 10 Sefirot are divided into different parts. So you've got the world of intellect. So it's known as Chochmah, Binah, and Da'at. And that's three components of understanding, which we're not going to go through now. And then we have the world of emotional responses. The emotion, which goes as Chesed on the right, Gevurah on the left, Teferet, Netzach, Hod, Yesod, and so on. And then Malchut. Malchut is leadership and implement. And in God's world, that means that God is ready now. He's expressed himself in 10 defined ways. The malchut within God is that power then to travel further and then to connect to something, so to speak, other than himself and to create the next world, right? And then he creates the world of Briah, and that's a creation. It's a very lofty spiritual creation, but it's already a world, a defined world. outside of God's presence, so to speak, and then the Malchut of Bria goes to the next world, and the next world goes to the next world, until we come to the world that we are. Right? So in other words, what God did was He chose these 10 definitions, and then those are the 10 definitions which we used as the foundation for all of existence. So in fact, in Kabbalah we learn that everything that's created in this world, in fact, can be backtracked to one of these 10 spheres. Just to give you an example. So if we have fire and water, right? So water is connected to the attribute of chesed. Now, water is a physical thing, right? But the properties of water is it's a giving property. It's like it pours. Water flows. So it's like the concept of love. It's like the concept of giving, right? So how is water created? You know, it was not that God just created a world. He created a world using these 10 foundations which were rooted in His own 10 definitions that He chose to manifest Himself in, right? And therefore, every detail of creation connects to a godly power. So water comes from the attribute of chesed, the chesed of the lowest world, which connected to the chesed of the higher world, and it goes all the way back to God's chesed, okay? Fire, on the other hand, is gevura, right? So fire is elevated. It withdraws. It goes back. Gevura means rejection. Gevura means you hold back, right? That's why aggression is gevura, because it rejects someone, right? Self discipline is the concept of gevura, because you hold back, right? So everything in this world is connected to one of the 10 spherot, or a combination of them. Every animal is connected to a particular spherot. So we know that an ox, Kabbalah says, is gevura. A sheep is chesed. Some animals are more tiferet, which means compassion, and so on. So every animal has a particular nature. Okay? Now, these 10 spherot are very different from each other. And in fact, let's take, for example, the two, because the creation of the world essentially comes from the 10 spherot, but mostly it comes mainly from the 7 emotions, which is why we have 7 days of the week, which is why God created the world in 6 days and rested on the 7th, because the 6 days are the first 6, and Shabbat is the 7th, right? But they're very different. So for example, you take chesed and gevura. Chesed and gevura are two opposite traits. Chesed is all about giving. Gevura is all about holding back. Yes, we have different permutations. There's chesed of gevura and gevura of chesed. And it's a very complicated story in Kabbalah, but just more or less, right? Chesed and gevura are very, very different. That's why fire and water clash with each other, right? But in God's world, He has all 10. Why does He have all 10? Because, remember, these are defined descriptions, but they're rooted in an infinite God. They're rooted in an undefined God. They're rooted in their manifestation. They all come from one source. The source is that God which is infinite and transcendent and undefined, who can choose to manifest Himself in any way He wants. So He chooses to have chesed, He has chesed. He chooses to have guri, He has guri. They both come from Him. And therefore, in His world, you have all 10. But when the world is created, the creations of the world are rooted in one or the other. So, for example, even angels. We are taught in Kabbalah in the higher worlds, you've got angels of love, angels of chesed, and angels of gevura. They're different. And each one is locked into their definition. Same thing with animals. Same thing with everything that we have in this world. Each thing has its property. Each thing has its definition. Except for a human being. Except for the human being. The human being has all 10. We have all 10. Now that's not to say that we don't have different personalities. We do. In fact, some of us are more chesed, some of us are more gevura, some of us are more tiferet, and again, maybe next week we'll talk about it more, but it's not for now, just because we're going to run out of time to explain what that means, what's a chesed personality, what's a gevura personality. I'm going to give some examples next week. But the point is that even those of us, for example, who are disposed more to one personality than the other, we possess the ability of all 10. So a chesed person can have gevura too. In fact, needs gevura. A gevura person needs chesed.
That's why we're the image
of God. Exactly. That's what it means with the image of God. That we are created with the imprint of all 10 spherot. Now, what's interesting is, right? Sorry?
That's what we do with each one.
Okay, that's a good question. That's right, exactly. Right. However, here comes the interesting thing, right? When we say that we created the image of God, because we have all 10, So in other words, what it means, the image of, when we talk about the image of God, what do we mean by God in this, in this instance? We mean God, what's referred to in Kabbalah is Adam Ha'elyon, the supernal man. Right? There's a, in a couple of weeks we're going to have the festival of Shavuot, and the first day of Shavuot in Shul, in the Haftarah, we read the famous vision of Ezekiel the prophet, Yechezkel, called the Merkava, where he saw an image of celestial beings, right? So he talks about the various worlds, and it's very, very cryptic part of Tanakh, very Kabbalistic. I mean, it's really not understood unless you learn Kabbalah. But he talks about the Adam She'ala Kisei, the man sitting upon the throne, referring to God. Why is it called the man? What does Adam mean? It means Adam Alion, the supernal man, meaning the world of Atzilut. That's what we're talking about. God, God as he chose to manifest himself in 10 descriptions. Right? Human beings are created with the Tselem Elokim, the image of God, because we have that godly imprint. We have the same 10 descriptions, obviously at a much lower level, but it's all rooted in his 10 definitions. And we have all 10, just like God does. Right? The interesting part is, it's not just our godly soul. Our animal soul also has all 10. Okay? So we talk about the human being being created in the image of God, doesn't only mean the godly soul is created in the image of God. The godly soul perhaps possesses something which is even above Atzilut. In other words, it possesses something which is really transcendent, which we'll talk about soon. But every part of us, even the animal soul, is created in the image of God. Even the animal soul has all ten definitions. Right? The difference, however, is that the animal soul is called the animal soul because the connection, the godly connection by the animal soul is not obvious. When it comes to the animal soul, it's a creation of God, but it's a creation of God where God has removed his obvious link to the soul. Yeah, does that make sense?
The whole
animal soul, yeah. Which means... We know it's a godly creation, but it doesn't feel that way. It doesn't feel itself that way. And therefore, what drives the animal soul? When there's an absence of godliness, what takes over? The ego. Right? That's why it's called animal soul, because it's impulsive and it understands itself only. Right? That's why animals don't have relationships like human beings. Animals don't possess the ability to connect to something else outside of them. Very different. I mean, there's an animal-type relationship, but not the same as human relationship, right? To really go out of their own world, that's a very difficult thing. But if we can... So ego, the Talmud tells us, an interesting thing. The Talmud tells us that, and Kabbalah, it's explained a lot, that there's any trait that we have, even if it's an animalistic trait, can be channeled. Meaning it's got a positive application, right? But there are exceptions. And the exceptions are the things that drive the animal soul to be destructive. And that's the ego. Anything that comes from ego needs to be eliminated. Ego is a terrible thing. Now, we all have an ego. Most of us, I assume. At different levels. And part of the human, part of growth is about letting go of ego. Or trying that ego shouldn't... I say letting go of ego, most of us will never get rid of our ego completely. But we need to at least be aware of it and try not let the ego drive our decisions. Right? Because in the consciousness of the soul, which means in the consciousness of how human beings operate, whether godly soul or animal soul, godly desires or physical desires for that matter, That's our consciousness, but there's also a subconscious. And what lives in our subconscious? What lives in our subconscious is two things. Either the ego, which is driving the animal soul and driving human being to be self-centered and pursuit of pleasure and temporary instant gratification and live without meaning and purpose and without something higher and deeper. Whereas also in our subconscious, even deeper than the ego, is the depth and the spark of our godly soul, right? Which is the spark which gives us the ability to give the godly soul more mastery and more control, where what drives us is more selflessness and a divine connection and something higher and something deeper, and to live a life of purpose and meaning and so on and so forth. Right? But ego and kas, rage is something that has no redeeming factor, as ego doesn't as well. Because rage is rooted in arrogance, which is for a different discussion. But anything that's rooted in arrogance means by definition that it's unholy, it's ungodly. It means it makes no room for something higher. Right? So that's why those have to be eliminated. But other than that, the specific definitions, the specific descriptions of the animal soul become very destructive and animalistic if we let them. But if we don't, if we channel them, they can become very, very beneficial. And next week I'll explain to you why if they come from the animal soul, they can be even more beneficial than things that come from the godly soul. But we'll leave that for next week. Okay? So I just want to give you an example for this, because one of my favorite ideas, an idea that comes from a Hasidic Rebbe, who happens to be an ancestor of mine, so I started studying his works a few years ago, called the Ishbitzer. And he explains a beautiful idea. He says there's a medrash. The medrash says that there was a peddler. That's what it says. The Hebrew word that's used in that medrash is hayruchel. Ruchel in Hebrew, resh vav chaf lamed, is a peddler. You know, in olden days, the peddlers go from town to town, sell wares and so on. So there was a peddler who went from town to town. And there was a great sage in a particular town called Rabbi Yanai. And this peddler, suddenly the students come to tell him that this peddler is making the following announcements, like he's advertising his wares. And he's saying, who wants, I have the potion of life. I have the photographer's here. Go on, you just take a few days from that side also. Thank you. But make sure you get everyone in. And from this side again. I've been told by the marketing team I've been, I have to come with pictures as well. Okay, sorry about that. It's the world we live in. So the peddler said, who wants to buy the potion of longevity? Right? Rabbi Yanai said, amazing thing. Go see what he's got to say. So they went to see, and they asked him, so how do you buy long life? So he quoted a verse in Tehillim, a verse in Psalms. And the verse in Psalms said, Mi ha'isha chefetz chaim, who wants long life? Famous verse in Psalms. Who wants to live long? He who guards his tongue from speaking evil. In other words, apparently not gossiping is a secret to long life. Okay. So they came back and they told Rabbi Yanai this thing, and Rabbi Yanai was amazed. He was so happy, he was incredibly amazed. So the Ishbitzer asked the question, he says, I don't understand the story. Rabbi Yanai was a big sage. He knew the book of Psalms before this peddler came to town. What did the peddler explain to him that he didn't know? I mean, anyone can open a book of Psalms. I mean, it happens to be a verse in Psalms that actually is part of the Shabbat prayers. We say every single Shabbat. It's a very famous verse, which Rabbi Yanai certainly knew. And he didn't need some peddler from some shtetl to come tell him that if you want life, mi aisha chafetz chayim, if you want life, you could stop gossiping. Well, that's obvious. I mean, we know that. So he taught it, so he can also teach it. I mean, what's... You know. He says an amazing thing. He says, if you look at the wording of the Medrash, he says, the Medrash tells us that the person who shared this idea was a peddler. And a peddler in Hebrew is a ruchel's called, right? Where do we find that word in the Torah? When the Torah talks about the prohibition of gossiping. Sorry?
Lerachel, to gossip.
Gossip, exactly. So the Pasuk says, Lo telech rachil. That's what it says in the Chumash. Don't gossip. And it says the word rachil. Why? A real gossiper is like a peddler. What's a peddler? A peddler is like, we call it in Yiddish, a kocheleffel. Like he takes one and he goes shares with the other. He's a busybody, right? A successful peddler has a certain personality. Personality, he knows where to find a good bargain. He knows where to sell the good bargain. He knows where to buy the soap. He knows who needs the soap. He's in the know, right? A gossiper has the same personality. A gossiper has the peddler personality. He knows where to find a good juicy piece of news. He knows where to tell a good piece of juicy news. He knows who's interested in which politics. Some people like Israeli politics. Some people like American politics. Someone like to talk about this guy, that guy, right? He knows this person. If you tell him about this rabbi, it's good. The other one knows this. Different. He, right? And the Midrash is very emphatic to say it was a peddler who went around. So Rabbi Yonai suddenly clicked an amazing thing. He understood that part of working on your personality is you don't eliminate ultimately a bad trait. You have to transform a bad trait. What happened over here? What happened was there was a peddler. What was the peddler? This peddler obviously had the nature of a gossiper. And perhaps previously he was a gossiper. He was a peddler. Is that what he did? He was a, right? And he wasn't selling cosmetics. He was selling messages. He was selling morality. Why was he doing that? Why is it called him a peddler? Because what this peddler taught Rabbi Yonai was that when you have a problem, you have a weakness, you have to find a positive expression of it. Because the weakness is intrinsically good. It's not bad. Okay? Because it's godly created. So if I have a peddler personality, and this guy knows it, listen, I love gossip. I love finding out information from this one and sharing it with the other guy. And he wanted to stop that, and he wanted to improve himself. So what did he do? He became a positive peddler. He shared, he became a peddler to teach how not to gossip. He became a peddler in sharing information and publicizing the message from the Psalms about that gossip, that abstaining from gossip is a secret to longevity. Right? So I'm bringing that only to sort of bring out and emphasize this idea that we created in the image of God, which means a couple of things. So let's just put this together a little bit. Which means that all of us, every part of us is part of the created in the image of God, which means intrinsically we're every part of us is good. We just need to know how to channel it, both the animal soul and the godly soul. But it also means the following. When we say we're created in the image of God, unlike other creations, because we have all 10 traits, it means the conclusion of all this is that personal growth means two things. Personal growth, first of all, means to know what our natural traits are and to make sure we channel them in the right direction. Right? So a person is more of a chesed person, a person is more of a gevurah person, that's okay. We each have an area of strength. We each have an area of emphasis. And that's good. We should nurture that. We just make sure that it's driven in the right direction because we know that it's intrinsic. In other words, no part of our personality is bad. We just, maybe some of the manifestation is bad and weak. And we have to know that it's all godly and it's all created in the image of God. And therefore, we have to know how to channel it. And the second part of personal growth is to understand that we possess, as human beings, we possess this ability to be infinite. What does it mean to be infinite? To embrace parts of ourselves which are not a natural personality. Which we'll talk about more next week. But to embrace, to do things which are hard for us. To do things which, you know, there's a common, in modern society, there's a common sort of phrase people talk about, this is not me. You know, I'm not going to do this because this is not me. I need to feel, it doesn't talk to me. I know it's good, it sounds right, but it doesn't talk for me. It doesn't work for me, right? In Judaism, that's a no-no. Why is it a no-no? Because Judaism is not about what talks to you, because it's about what is right. It's about what is moral. Why? It doesn't have to talk to us. Oh, it might be hard to embrace. It might be a difficult journey to take. It might take a lot of effort, right? But there's no such thing as saying, you got to, you know, we talk about acceptance, and acceptance is a good thing, and tolerance is a good thing, but we shouldn't accept ourselves that much. Meaning, there's a difference between accepting and judging, right? So judging someone is not a good, and judging ourselves is not good either. But we shouldn't accept ourselves. Meaning we shouldn't accept ourselves the way I am, the way we are, because we need to improve. And we shouldn't say, I cannot grow in this area because it's not me. So that's untrue because it is us, because we possess all 10 powers of the soul. We possess all possibilities of personality. And therefore, if we need to engage, if we know that there's an area of improvement, there's an area of personal growth that we need to engage in, and it's clearly not us, it clearly means going way beyond our comfort zone, way beyond who we are. We possess that trait. Not, obviously, maybe, not in a revealed way, because we each have our traits that we are stronger in our consciousness and in sort of more obvious naturally who we are. And we do have a personality. We have a personality because we live in this world, and this world is governed by differences. That's fine. And we should nurture that personality. But with human beings, the greatness of growth is that we're not bound by that personality. We're not bound by any of it. In fact, the Talmud tells us, you know, I've said this before many times, but there's a famous debate of what shapes a human being's personality. Is it nature or nurture, right? Famous debate. The Jewish view is both. Both have a very big impact on a person. So my DNA, the day of the week I'm born in, apparently, according to the Talmud, the hour that I'm born in during the day, my physical DNA, my spiritual DNA, plus nurture, the way my parents brought me up, my friends, my environment, everything has a real impact. And that's a true thing, and that's what we need to be very careful of, how we educate people and so on and so forth. But, although it's all true, we are bound by none of it. Right? You got to be, in a court of Jewish law, there's very little leeway given for people saying, well, you know, I was brought up badly, so that's why I need leniency. Unless a person is clinically insane, that's different. Right? Insanity is a good claim, because that's a sickness, that's something else. But as long as a person still possesses the power of free choice, the human responsibility is endless. There's never an excuse. Why? Because you possess all 10 powers, because you created the image of God. And therefore you possess that power of infinity. God gave us the gift of infinity. To be infinite, to be more than we are.
Going beyond ourselves.
Now, the good news is, it's all good news, but the important thing to think, I'm not going to take long, because I want to sort of wrap it up a little bit, but the important thing to understand is, lest this become overwhelming, which it shouldn't become, that's not the point of it, that it's not about perfection. In other words, this infinite expression of the human being is not expressed by becoming perfect. It's expressed by becoming a little bit different. In other words, in Kabbalah and in the works of Chassidut, it talks about the greatness of pushing the boundary. Because when you push the boundary, it also has to be realistic. If you get inspired by the power of infinity, when you go to sleep one night, resolving to become a saint the next morning, it's not going to work. Because we are human beings. So we don't express our infinity by becoming perfect. That's not the goal. And therefore we're all different areas, but we do express it by the willingness and the determination to embrace something that's hard. To channel that which we already have into something more positive. To do more good in the areas which we are already good. But actually also to embrace an area of growth that is hard. And we might still fail. But when we just take that step of pushing ourselves a little bit, it's a little bit like physical fitness, right? If you go to the gym, if you overdo it, you'll have a heart attack. But if you always remain within your comfort zone, you're wasting your money. Right?
Yeah.
It's painful. I mean, just look into a gym. You see everyone's grimacing like they look like they aren't they? They look like they're having a rough time, but they all seem happy. They keep paying membership. Why? Because they know, no pain, no gain, right? But no, but so seriously, that's in the physical sense. But the personality is exactly the same thing. And it's constant training. That's why it's a lifelong mission. Was this clear?
Yes.
Okay. So what I want to do next week is bring it down, sort of break it down a little bit, right? This is the foundation of it. But sort of give examples and understand what does that mean and how does the soul actually work and how do we repair something where we failed and how does that impact how we view failure and give examples of sort of what sort of the growth means.
Sorry, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Are your children born, because you talked about DNA, with some of your or the partner, the father or the mother, the same traits? And I think I'm expressing it incorrectly. I want to know if one's traits that come from God, do they split to go? Because two children in a family...
Again, we're all created with all 10 of these traits, right? But there are some that are more prevalent, some that are more stronger. It's not that simple that just, you know, if I'm a certain type of person, my child's going to be like that, because it has so many different factors that govern the personality of a person. But yeah, it has an effect. Of course it has an effect.
But your environment does too.
Yeah, the environment, nurture, lots of things. Lots of things play a role. But we're bound by it. But we're not bound by any of it. That's the point. Right? Yeah.
What's the difference between the ten sfarot and the yud gimel midot that Hashem also wants us to mimic?
Now, the yud gimel midot is a whole other thing. Yud gimel midot is the rachamim. That's the... So, tiferet, which is the middle one, is compassion. And that goes all the way up to God's intrinsic compassion, which He wants us to emulate. But that's a whole other... In other words, that's beyond... In other words, that's overlooking mistakes and forgiving and but that's nothing to do with personality. That's like where tshuva comes from, that even if we mess up, we've always got a chance to repair because there's this concept of compassion. You see what I'm saying? Let's just I want to just put it together. I want to internalize this, go away with it properly. So maybe let's just spend a few minutes just with a short meditation, if that's okay. And I'll ask you to just get to come, because it's always good to internalize it and just to think about it, reflect upon it a little bit. So, just in your own way, just take a comfortable position and relax. And
so, if I have
to get you take the comfortable chair, exactly. Very good, perfect. And just sort of try and focus a little bit, and when you're ready, just slowly close your eyes. And what I want you to do is just turn your attention first and foremost to your breath. Just focus on your breathing, breathing in and out. Just tapping into the rhythm of our breathing, feeling the inhaling and exhaling just for a few moments. Just staying focused on our breathing, just remember that the word for breath in Hebrew is neshima, which is the same word as neshama, a soul. Every breath that we take is an expression of our soul. The soul is the godly spark which gives us life. At its core, it's pure, it's fresh. Every new breath is an expression of purity. When we wake up in the morning, Modeh Ani, we thank God for giving back Anishama, the power of life, which is also the spark of infinity. It's the godly infusion. It's the gift of growth. Being alive, breathing, equals the ability to grow. To go beyond ourselves. Connecting higher, deeper, be more godly. Just continue breathing for a few moments, and with each breath, try and focus on what defines you, not your personality, but the ability to go beyond. My soul has all 10 powers, godly powers, the godly imprint, the Tzelem Elokim. What defines me is the spark of the soul, the spark of godliness, and not my specific personalities. When we wake up in the morning and we thank God for our breath and for our soul, it's also acknowledging a day ahead of growth, pushing our boundaries, going beyond, connecting higher. Every part of us is godly. Every part of us can be used for the good. Hold on to that, take it with you. Try and reflect how it can be put into practice. So we'll leave it there and go back to just a short one and take this with you until the next week. We'll break it down, as we said, but the core message is very clear. Each part of us can be channeled. It does need a bit of work on our ego, which we'll talk about more next week. But ultimately, what defines us is the power to be infinite and to improve, and to always take the next step. So thank you for coming.
Thank you.
And hopefully we'll see you next week.
Thank you. Very good.
Thank you, Rabbi.
You're very welcome.